In this episode of the Deming Institute podcast, David Langford revisits the show to talk about the state of education, focusing on education's challenges, opportunities, and history of applying the Deming philosophy. Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, host and producer of the Deming Institute podcast. Our guest today is David Langford. David has worked with Dr. Deming in education. And what we want to talk to David about today is education in general and the state of education and the system and how it's set up. That's a pretty broad subject, David. Where would you like to begin?
Hi, Tripp. Thanks for having me back again. It's good to be back again.
Glad to have you.
Yes. The state of education in general. So we can talk worldwide. We can talk just North America. There's all kinds of things going on. But one of the things I kind of wanted to talk about today was the short-term thinking that Dr. Deming often warned corporations about, only being concerned about short-term profits and quarterly profits and not being concerned about the long-term longevity of a corporation and their ability to stay in business and produce high quality products and services.
But you don't have that problem in education, though, because there's there's profit, right? In a corporation, how does that play in education?
Well, in essence, people have translated that into education, that profit basically meaning test scores. So standardized test scores. I spent 15 years working in Australia. It's the same problem that they have there. And then people get rated and ranked based on test scores alone. It drives people to not think about long-term programs or long-term benefits to students. People start, and Dr. Deming, warned very clearly of this. I mean, people will get any numbers that you want them to get, even if they have to destroy the organization to get those numbers. So, I mean, we have all the famous examples like what happened at Wells Fargo and places like that, where all they were doing is setting arbitrary goals and numbers, and people got the numbers all right.
Yeah.
If they had to sacrifice the people in the process. Well, to me, same thing as happening in education. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we've seen it in education, right? I mean, we saw it in Washington, D.C., where I think it was Ree was the superintendent of D.C. schools, and a bunch of teachers were changing test scores in order to achieve the numbers. We saw the same thing in Atlanta. And people become under fire from that. So the same situation that Wells Fargo went through, where people have to game the system in order to achieve the results, it's that people get very creative when they're forced into a situation where it's like, you gotta show the numbers or you're out. And so what do you do? I mean, they're your system. The culture changes and people then do what they can to survive.
Yeah. The current environment I'm in, with Ingenium schools, the number that, everybody's most concerned about is the percentage of students who are meeting or exceeding standards for that grade level. And that sounds great. It sounds like, that seems normal. We should be able to have everybody at that level. But the problem I deal with currently is that right now, 90% of all of our students are coming to us below grade level. So in many cases, even if teachers do a tremendous job and improve that student's growth by a whole year or more, in a single year, when they take that state exam, they're still below grade level. And that's translated into a percentage and then extrapolated out. So it's a classic problem. Deming talked about, you know, it's a whole system of interrelated parts to the whole. And unless we really take that focus and understand different systems are dealing with different problems. In many cases, I have over 50% of students that are first-generation English speakers. So that adds a whole complexity. So not only do we have to, you know, get them, if they come to us two or three grade levels below where they're supposed to be, we have to get them to grade level, but we're also dealing with a language barrier and issues that we need to bring. We also have very high level of students that have significant trauma in their home lives and background. And so trying to create an environment where schools are really safe place to be many times is contradictory to, we want a safe place to be, but you better get these test scores or else.
You know, there's a number of things that start to go through my mind as I'm listening to you talk, David. And one of the first ones that struck me in the head was, you know, we're talking about how test scores got manipulated in D.C. and Atlanta. But, you know, if you're getting 90% of the people that come into your school system already below the grade level that they're entering and you're having to, you know, raise their level, there's going to be pressure on that system then to not get people who are below the grade level to begin with, that you start to sort through kids. Oh, we don't want that one because he's or she is starting below. We want somebody who's above. So therefore we can already be ahead, right, of the, ahead of the game. So I see that coming
Well, one of the great myths about charter schools that's perpetuated is that charter schools exist because they can choose their own students, which is a total myth. It's against the law. Well, at least in California, where I'm working now, it's against the law to do that. We have to take every student that comes to us, no matter what their difficulties or special needs or anything else, and enroll them. But on the other hand, the traditional public schools play a game where they have magnet schools and set cutoffs that they'll only accept certain kids that have certain test scores or grade levels, et cetera. And then charter schools are often compared against those kinds of schools. but we have no ability to, you know, select our students. We have to deal with what we're dealing with. So, and it's a double-edged sword because we've become pretty well known, and parents are very happy with what we do with special needs students and special education. And we have a very good department for that, and we really support kids a lot. But that also, word gets out in the community that we're really good at that, so we have a higher percentage of kids with special needs coming to us than surrounding school districts. And so that takes a massive amount of extra resources, and we're dealing with all that. We're doing, you know, the best we can to do that. But, you know, whether or not we can get all those kids at or above grade level in a single year coming into the system is, you know, I have yet to figure out how to do that. We can show a lot of growth in all these different areas, et cetera, but we still may not be able to compete with districts like what you say that already have 50% of their students coming in at grade level.
Okay.
So it's not a level playing field at all.
So you've got all these kind of unfair playing fields that you have. Were to step back and kind of take a look at the system, you mentioned a couple of things, you know, that go into an education system. You mentioned the trauma of some of the kids that you're getting into the system. You mentioned that they're starting a couple grade levels below where maybe they should be already. We haven't talked about teachers or parents and other things in the environment. What other system things are prominent in your mind that really play a major factor into what goes into a test score? And maybe not just a test score, but into the education system that you're trying to build. So what are some of those other components that are influencing and they're not necessarily they're going to be different by district, and I understand that, or by each education system. But what are the ones that you see, have seen, or maybe you're currently seeing?
Yes, if people haven't been to dimming training or haven't been trained to think like that, like understanding variation and understanding that a system and understanding continual improvement and how to go about and work on something, then people actually, systems commit what Deming called one of the deadly diseases. They treat special cause performance or behavior as if it was common. So, and this runs rampant in school boards. A school board member gets one phone call from an irate parent, and the next thing you know, at the school board meeting, they're proposing a whole new program or something that affects everybody in the whole organization. And if you don't understand statistically special and common cause variation, it's really easy to fall into that trap. Or to say one teacher is disgruntled or unhappy with the direction that things are going and what's going on, instead of understanding, okay, this is a special cause, and do we have common cause data is telling us about, you know, how the rest of the system functions and what's going on, and then treating special causes if it's special. So I constantly see in the news districts being pulled, you know, to and fro by special cause variation, just, And they just have to respond to that. And it takes a great amount of strength and willpower to understand, okay, this is special cause. It doesn't mean we're going to ignore it, but we're only going to deal with this as one irate parent who's got this problem. Now, it could be an indicator of a common cause issue. That's why you don't want to ignore it. You want to investigate is the key word. And find out, okay, is there any truth to this? And are they actually the tip of a iceberg or a spear where those vocal people are actually pointing out something that's a big systemic problem? So without that kind of background and training, there's just a huge amount of tampering that goes on. So, you know, and that's where you get things like, having spent 30 years consulting with school districts, the common thing was, what's the flavor of the month? What are we into this month? And that's just a great example that people don't invest their time and talents and effort in understanding a particular program or a process that's put into place, because they've been around for quite a while and they know that, you know, even this too will pass. And so I'll do the minimum effort. I'll do whatever I'm told I have to do, but that's about as far as it will go. And so unless school boards have that long-term thinking as well and commitment to, you know, moving, you know, in a long-term direction, it's going to falter. Same thing in my situation. When I was hired 2.5 years ago, I made it very clear to the board and everybody involved, this is probably going to be 3 to 5 years before we see really significant results, simply because you have to go through a whole process of retraining everybody to think differently and understanding how to read data and how to make decisions and variation. And then there's all the unforeseen things at work, like fear in the organization and just uncovering fear that's been put into place for years. That's one thing. For instance, when I took over at my system, they had a whole bonus structure for administration that they could get bonuses based on test scores and stuff. And while I was able to eliminate that immediately because I had the formal position, there's also this long-term results of the fear that had driven into the system. And how do we go about, you know, constantly training, persuading people, getting them to understand that, no, we're not going to operate like that anymore. And you can't just come in and tell people that. They have to see it, and they have to see it consistently for a long period of time. And to me, that's what Deming's talking about, the constancy of purpose, that, okay, we got this constancy of purpose, and no, we're not going to go this direction or that direction. And, you know, we know where we're headed and what we're trying to accomplish, and we're committed to going there. And that's a rare thing. And when I originally learned about Deming's concept of profound knowledge, I thought it was rather presumptuous that, you know, he would say, well, you got to have profound knowledge. But after 30 years in management training and consulting, it's pretty rare that you find somebody with that kind of knowledge and fortitude to manage differently. And therefore, it is very profound when you run into it.
You know, there's a lot that you said there. You know, one of the first things that you talked about in there is something I thought of when I was consulting with banks, and that is that almost invariably, any bank that you walk into has a story of somebody who embezzled money.
Absolutely.
You know, 10 years ago. And they spend, now they, $50,000 was stolen. It usually wasn't huge amounts. It was, I mean, $50,000 still not a small amount, but it wasn't like $20 million. But they'll spend, with the systems that they put in place, $5 million a year in workarounds and things to make sure that never happens again. And this is that concept of special cause as a common cause. It almost, and talk about fear, you know, in an organization, people are afraid to challenge it because then, oh, well, you must be someone plotting to embezzle, you know, from the bank. So fear manifests itself in different ways. And so one of the questions that I was going to ask you is, as you've worked in, you know, education systems, is it usually the same types of things that you see? You know, I understand this the test scores, but I assume there's other things that you see causing fear, whether it's in students, whether it's in a board, whether it's in teachers, parents. What does fear look like in education?
Yes, absolutely. well, Dr. Deming is the one that pushed me into creating a consulting organization a long time ago, and probably even before I was old enough or ready to do that. But I did that and learned a lot over the years. But one of the things that I always would sort of smile to myself, because I'd go into a university or a school or organization, start to work with them, and people would usually start out with some kind of phrase that, like, oh, but we're different.
Okay.
And
in what way were they saying that? Was it many different ways, or
Yeah, well, I always remember Deming's comment when the people ask him were the Japanese able to do what they were able to do so quickly because of the Japanese culture? Mm. And he used to get very irate and adamant about that and said, you know, there's no differences in culture in the things that really count. Mm. And it probably took me a good 10 years to figure out what he was talking about, because, you know, obviously I'd go to different places in the world. Okay, there's a different culture. But what he was talking about really was when you get down to intrinsic motivation and pride of workmanship and what drives people to want to do a good job, whether that's in a classroom or an assembly line or in management or whatever it might be, it's basic intrinsic motivation factors. And languages might be different, and many other things might be different as well. But intrinsically, people want the right to have joy in their work. And Deming made that very clear. And, you know, we talk about it in our school system, a right to joy in learning, that children have a right to joy in their learning. And and this is also borne out by neuroscience, that all the neuroscience points to, that if people are not engaged in enjoying the process of what they're doing and finding meaning in what's going on, then you're just left to extrinsic motivators. Now I just have to give you prizes, games, gimmicks, bonus pay, et cetera, to get results. because you have no deep-seated understanding about why you're doing this other than because if I get an A, my dad gets me $5. Mm-hmm. And so that causes the same kinds of things that you were talking about in banking. It causes the same kind of things in schools. I mean, that's why we have cheating in classrooms. And when you think about it, it's a crazy concept. I mean, what would drive a student to sacrifice their personal integrity to cheat? Well, there's got to be something wrong in that process. They haven't been prepared for an assessment. They don't know why they're taking the assessment. That it may be a one-off kind of thing, that whatever grade you get is going to determine your future, and you can't risk that. And so, you know, people will do whatever they have to do. And then when that happens, we love to blame the person that gets caught and then never blame the system. And Deming was very clear that 98% of the result, many systems coming from the system itself, 95, 98, I've heard lots of different things like that. But the thing is, statistically, it's huge. So that's why you should always, if you have a number of students that are cheating or bullying or bad behavior or doing things that you don't think are constructive, the first thing you should look at is, what are we doing in the system that's causing this kind of behavior? And what can we change systemically that might allow people to have joy and meaning in their work and learning? And therefore, then we don't have to have people catching people cheating.
Yeah.
And working through things. So.
Yeah, no, you said a lot in there as far as the... Yeah, there has to be, it seems to me, and maybe I'm oversimplifying it, that either the fear or some type of extrinsic reward or a combination of the two lead people to take negative actions like the ones that you're talking about, whether it's bullying or whatever. And I would think.
Yeah, it's always true. And in neuroscience, why do we use those things? Why has it evolved that we do those things? Because if I offer you a reward, an extrinsic motivator, a punishment, a reward, or something to do something, it narrows your focus. Mm-hmm. So you're not looking left and right and all around you. You're no longer concerned about my colleagues or the other students in the class. You're no longer concerned about relationships, anything else. You just become totally myopic and focused on getting that thing. So whether that's grades or a bonus or whatever, you know, you're driving people to just forget all else and get these numbers, no matter what harm it might cause to you personally or the people around you, et cetera. And so you could use those things to get numbers pretty quickly. And it's true in schools. It's true in business as well. You can get the numbers. The problem is you can't sustain that. So, you know, if I give you a $500 bonus this year, next year you want a $1,000 bonus. Or pretty soon you start to say, it's all the work, time, and effort I put in, and I only got a $500 bonus. So I'm not going to do that next year.
Let me ask
you.
I was going to ask you. You were talking about, for the most part, not necessarily, this conversation go a lot of different places, but I'm curious about your view of when you overlay this thinking, when you're looking at it like a school board. I mean, what are their fears and motivations and things of that sort? Or is it so hard to uncover those types of things? I know you've worked with many boards, you know, in many schools. What do you see when you look at the school boards? What are the pressures that they feel?
Yes. well, in many cases, you know, people, I wouldn't say always, but many times people run for a board because they have a set agenda themselves. So maybe I have children in the school system, and so I want to run for the board because I want to make, you know, life better for my children. Mm-hmm. Or I have a pet project or a pet peeve, or and in some cases, people are running for school board because they know that's a springboard to running for governor. Mm. So when you get a board that's mixed with people that do really care about children and what's and they have the long-term effects of things and want to think through things, but they're being outvoted by people who are just there for short-term thinking. So, you know, if I can get test scores turned around in this district in a single year, that might catapult me into the mayor's office. But the same kind of thing that goes on. And test scores are especially in the United States, it's a huge political football, you know, now that just goes back and forth and back and forth. And it's, to me, it's just sort of kind of ironic, but that the person that created a standardized test never intended them for this purpose and said that they weren't reliable. Hmm. But yet we've put all this time, money, and effort in creating these massive systems, all centered around just how do you get test scores and then keep people from cheating on tests and working through that. So the same thing happens with a school board. So, you know, to turn that around, you have to do a lot of training with new board members that come on. And that's one of the things I'm trying to establish is what's the onboarding process for new board members that might come on. How do we sort of pre-board them, have them look at our constancy of purpose and the noble cause that we're aligned around and the principles and et cetera, and make sure if you want to be on the board that you understand that these are the kinds of things we're going to be focusing on and moving forward, and sort of helping board members sort of select themselves before they apply to be on our board. In our case, we don't have an elected board. We have an appointed board. So anybody can apply to be on our board that wants to help us improve education. So sometimes when I talk to traditional public schools, they're like, oh gosh, wouldn't that be great just to have, you know, appointed board members. Well, it's not like I just get to pick them. people can apply to be on the board, and then we have an ad hoc committee of board members that interviews them. They go through a process, and, you know, I may very well not want somebody on the board, but that doesn't mean that they won't end up there. So even in our situation, you know, with charter schools, it sounds like it would be so much better. And sometimes it is, and sometimes it's even worse than that. I had a long-serving superintendent that I talked to before I took over this superintendent's job, and I said, what's the number one key advice that you can give me, you know, taking over a superintendent's job? He'd been superintendent for a very large district for 35 years. And he said, be able to count to four. I said, what are you talking about? Yeah. He said, well, if you have seven board members, you better be able to count to four. And that's exactly right.
So when you look at that, do you see ways to improve it, or is it just kind of locked into the system and it can't be changed? You got to believe that something can change, or at least maybe the motivations behind it, or maybe even the fears behind it. I don't know.
It would take, you know, maybe it would take a board president and a superintendent working together well and both understanding like dimming system of profound knowledge and then consistently making decisions and providing board training to the rest of the board and working together continually to create a different way to think about, you know, solving problems. But so many districts have been in a mode of, one superintendent I started to work with, I said, well, what's been your mode for improvement up until now? And he very clearly said to fire people. Mm. So, you know, if you don't get the scores or you can't do the job, we just fire you and then find somebody else. And so if that's your mode of trying to improve things, it's super expensive and time consuming and creates massive fear in the organization. And so you just start running an organization that's just based on fear. That's not a great place to work. What Deming said is pretty soon the only people you'll be left with are the people who can't find a job someplace else. And I found that to be very true.
That's interesting. So it's key to have a good working relationship then, from your viewpoint, at least in the existing system, between the superintendent and the president of the school board or the leader of the school board. I think that's an important thing. Of course, that's important for anything. If they don't have a shared aim, then it makes it very difficult to kind of, you know, forge ahead. And it also, I was in an interview with Doug Hall. We had a lot of conversation about something called commander's intent in the military. And they're talking about, you know, the old military was all command and control. Everybody, you know, you were told what to do. That way, it's just, you know, from rank and file, basically. And
you do it without question.
And you do it without question. That's right. And nowadays, they found that to be not very useful. You know, you get into situations and it's, you know, take the hill, but you figure out how to do it, you know, type of thing. And so they've come up with something in the military called commander's intent, which is, there's a whole paragraph associated with it, but it basically boils down to, if you're in a situation, you don't know what to do, that's what commander's intent comes in. It gives you kind of what the mission is, that you're trying to achieve. And therefore, when you're in gray areas or things change, that, you know, it basically leaves it to you as the person with the most knowledge to make the right decision. So, you know, I almost think of that when you're talking about, you know, some of these things. You know, you can't overmanage the details, you know, associated with something that another Deming's rants that he'd off talk about and still is true today, is where you get a, you know, somebody from a different system, you know, runs in, thinks that they know everything because they went to school sometime in their past, and then say, here's all the changes that you need to make, that you're looking at a way to not, when you want to acclimate people to the system that have knowledge of the system, and getting them knowledge is, matter of fact, it's one of the things I've added years ago to my consultant practices. I continually ran into trying to establish an aim with people who don't understand the system. Yeah, and as a consultant, that's me too. And once they see the system, then they can start to make some changes there, you know, associated with it. This whole concept of commander's intent, and then also having the knowledge to be able to establish an aim, I think are really important. I would assume it would be the same in education, wouldn't you think?
Yes, and I don't want to appear to throw anybody under the bus, like you know, school board members or administrators or teachers or parents.
Oh, they're all doing the best they can. They all want.
That's right. Yeah. And but they all have. Even when I see things, when I think, oh my gosh, why in the world would you try to make that happen, or why would you want to do that? I have to remind myself that their intent is, you know, somewhat noble. They want to see things improved, and this is really the only method that they know of, you know, to try to get things to improve. And so, you know, how can you blame them? How could they know? Because they don't have any other way to think about things. So when you see a particular board member or staff member or something that seems like that, you know, they have a bad intent, I always had to just remind myself of that and remember that nobody really comes into a system wanting just to destroy it. No, I've never met a board member or administrator or anybody say, oh, I'm going to get this job just so I can destroy it and try to do that as quickly as I can. And even I had to learn that lesson with children coming into my classrooms early on, because, you know, you'd have students that looked like they were trying to destroy everything and really, really difficult to deal with and everything else. But you, deep down, you started to realize, no, actually, they do want to come and learn. You just need to get all the system stuff that are keeping them from that purpose out of the way. And every time I kept removing those kinds of barriers, I would uncover these gems of students who really did want to learn if they felt like you really cared about them and you really wanted them to learn. But if all you really cared about was getting your grades turned in on Friday and you didn't really care what grade they got, the students pick up on that immediately. So,
yeah, there's a story that you told. I quote some of the things from our conversations quite often, David, and I think if you listen to other podcasts, you'd probably not only the Deming Institute one, but some of the other podcasts that I've launched, I'll reference some things. But one of the stories that is indelible in my memory banks is the one that you told about, you know, all the students were coming to class late, you know, and using mm-hmm. that methodology, how you got the students to basically, well, what's wrong with the system? Is everybody coming to class late? And it was invariably because teachers didn't start to teach something until 12 minutes into the class or whatever the number was. You know, it's that learning.
Well, there's a couple of things I want to point out about that is that oftentimes teachers might ask somebody, you know, well, why are you coming to class late? And they might give you an answer, mm-hmm. but you're not taught to think, okay, well, how widespread is that? So when I go to a class and I have them brainstorm all the possible reasons why you might be late, and then I have the entire class prioritize it, and the teacher doesn't start on time, comes out to be number one, that's telling me pretty strongly this is a systemic problem.
Right.
And if I change this, because it's coming from everybody in the organization is prioritizing it, if I change that, I probably have a pretty good chance of seeing overall data improve. The other thing that runs in, you bring that up, but people run into is, so they might do something like that and make a change like that, but then they don't get perfection. So all of a sudden the next day, 100% of the kids aren't coming to class on time. So then they say, oh, well, see, I tried that and it didn't work. But I always try to bring people, I try to bring them back to thinking, okay, did you see some level of improvement? And whether we're talking about an individual, a whole class, a whole school, a whole organization, generally I'll have people say, oh yeah, well, you know, things got better. And, you know, actually did see a percentage of students that were more on time, but, you know, we still have these kids that are not, you know, they just love to go right back to a special cause thinking. So back to what we started with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no. Good conversation. I always pick up some little nuggets from you when we talk. What's to finish off this conversation? Is there any clarification of anything we've talked about that you'd like to make, or is there anything I failed to ask that maybe you wanted to get out there about the kind of the state of education?
No, it's just that you know, I don't want anybody to think that I don't think there are pockets of excellence. There are states where things are going really well. There are school districts, there are charter schools, there's parochial schools, there's private schools that you can point to. And there's lots of just pockets. But when we talk about the state of education, you know, politically, that we're always looking at the entire country or much bigger systems. Are we going to see that improve? And, there's just no evidence that anything we're doing on that kind of a level is having any systemic impact in the long-term process. So,
okay. All right. Well, it's good to catch up with you again. We want to checking in with you to see how, what you're thinking about the state of education is and some of the things that you're running into, because you're on the front lines too. So, it's always interesting to get that view, especially through that Deming lens that you have. So we really appreciate you sharing your time.
Thanks, Trip. I always remember I might be on the cutting edge, but it's also the bleeding edge. So.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, huh? cuts both ways.
Yeah. cuts both ways. So.
All right.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Deming Institute podcast. Stay.